The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, everyone. This is Annabelle. Welcome back to our Citizens Intervention Series. We have with us our main guest, Dean Baker, economist Dean Baker, who is the author of False Profit, Recovering from the Bubble Economy. And he is the co-director of Center for, can you introduce yourself?
Center for Economic and Policy Research.
That's right, sorry. But he's been advocating for the financial transaction tax for some time. And it's really probably very exciting for you that it's gaining so much support and momentum right now. So we're really excited to talk to you about this. Joining me to co-host is Will Rice. He's the coordinator of the Coffee Party Commonwealth Project, and I'm sure you all know him as one of our great characters who advocates for corporate personhood rights. And we have Eric Beiler here, who is the co-founder of the Coffee Party, and he's, yeah, thanks for coming along and joining the conversation. Hey, Will.
Hi, Annabelle. Thanks for having me on. This is a really interesting topic for me and for the people that I'm working with right now on the Coffee Party Commonwealth Project, because it's essentially a piece of the tax equity issue, which is what we're interested in. And we can talk more about that. But why don't we start by, welcome, Dean, by having, Dean, you just describe what a financial transaction tax is.
Yeah, the basic story is that it would be a very small tax on financial trades of financial assets like stock, bonds, various types of derivatives, option, futures, credit, default swaps, that would have very little impact on the productive use of these assets, the normal use, people buying and buying stock for, you know, retirement, their kids' college, that sort of thing. What it would do is have a very big impact and people are actively speculating in these assets, because if you're buying and selling them all the time, then even a very small tax could add up to be lots of money. And there are different rates that have been thrown out there. I had proposed a rate with a friend of mine, Bob Pollan, at the University of Massachusetts, where you would tax stock trades at the rate of 0.25% on each side, and trades of other assets like credit default swaps, derivatives, would be taxed at a considerably lower rate because those are shorter-term assets. Those would just be like 1/100th or 2/100ths of 1%. But other rates have been put out there. There's a bill before Congress now that was just introduced last month by Senator Harkin from Iowa and Representative Fazio in the House from Oregon that would have a tax of just 3/100ths of 1%. On all trades, both stocks, bonds, derivatives. And it was really striking because that's actually been scored now by the Joint Tax Committee, and that would raise over $400 billion over the next decade, according to their calculations. So I think that just shows that there is a lot of potential to raise money through this tax in a way that has very, very little impact on really the vast majority of people in the country. It really would just affect basically Wall Street and people who are engaged in active financial speculation.
Right. I wanted to ask you about the history of such taxes, but I just wanted to put in that I know that the United States already, in essence, has a tax like that because I own stocks and bonds, and when I buy or sell them, on the statement, there's always a box that says SEC fee, for Securities and Exchange Commission fee, and it's always a tiny amount. It may be a $10,000 transaction, and it's, you know, 43 cents or something. I don't know, but it's a negligible amount, and yet, as I understand it, that's the money being raised to pay for the Securities and Exchange Commission, which regulates stock trading.
That's right. There's a tax on both stock trades that finances the Securities and Exchange Commission. I should know, be able to know the exact amount. I think it's somewhere around 0.8 thousandths of 1%. So it's an extremely small tax.
It's, It's pennies on a $1,000 transaction, yeah.
Yeah, and there's also a tax on trades of options and futures that's used to finance the Commodity Futures Trading Commission. So we do have these taxes in place now. We actually did have larger taxes that were in place until the 60s. I think it was 64 that it was removed. At that time, the tax on stock trade was called a stamp tax. The UK still has a stamp tax, but we had this in place till 64. It was 0.04%, 0.04% on stock trades, and on new issues of stock, it was 0.12%. So there's precedent even in the United States. Most other countries have had stock transfer taxes. Sometimes they apply it to other securities, and some of them are still in existence. As I mentioned, UK has a tax that's 0.5%. That was actually what Bob Pohl and I were looking to when we said that would be a reasonable number, because we know they actually have that in the UK. So
right.
you could look at different rates. It's not a strange animal. It's been around, as you're saying, in the U.S. It's still around at a very low rate. It's been around at a somewhat higher rate in years past. And in several other countries, it's still in existence today.
And I'm sorry, go ahead, Annabelle.
Yeah, so I'm just curious about, like, what's the difference between what, you know, we're describing and what's already in place in Britain, and what even people in Britain want, what they're calling the Robin Hood tax. Like, what's essentially the difference there?
Well, Britain's tax on stock, I think, is very, very good, and they raised the equivalent of 0.2 to 0.3% of their GDP on the tax each year. That'd be $30 to $40 billion a year, and they're just taxing stock trades. And this dates back to the 17th century. I was trying to find out when it began. I couldn't find out when, and someone put down, I finally found a source that said 1696 is how far back it dates to. So it's been around a long time. So that's a great tax, you know, on stock trades, and it, you know, it shows people are saying it can't be done. Well, it is being done. They're raising money, and of course, the London Stock Exchange is still one of the biggest exchanges in the world, so it hasn't shut them down. So this argument that, oh, my God, they'll all go out of business, you know, it's obviously not true. But the argument that I and many others have made is that, well, it's good they're taxing stock, but people are engaged in speculation of a wide range of assets, and particularly sort of the high rollers, the people who most might want to pay the tax, they find it easy to evade the stock tax by doing things like going into options. You could buy options in stock. So if you don't want to pay the tax, you could buy an option. You don't pay the tax on the option in the UK. You just pay tax when you actually buy the stock. So they could largely evade it by basically speculating in options. And then you have a whole other range of derivative instruments. Credit default swaps are one that have gotten notoriety lately, both because of AIG and the meltdown here and also in the context of the euro crisis. Again, no reason that shouldn't be taxed at a very modest level. So the argument that I and others, the people campaigning in the UK, they're saying, well, that's great, you're taxing the stock there, but let's tax the whole array of assets so that we don't make it easy for people to evade it if they don't feel like paying it.
Right.
I see.
Mm-hmm. I think an important point here is, and one of the things we're trying to do with the Commonwealth Project, is to point out fallacies in arguments against regulations like this or taxes, claims that it's going to somehow affect the middle class. If you're a middle class person, or even someone in the 1% or the top percentages of personal wealth or income, and own stocks and bonds, and maybe even more complex things, but the point is you buy and sell relatively infrequently, this is going to have no impact on your willingness to invest or on the income that you get. What this will have an effect on is large institutions that are trading millions of shares a minute, right? I mean, for someone who's going to buy and hold stock and just purchase occasionally, this is not going to be an impediment to that that activity, is it?
Exactly. You know, and I have fun with people who think this is going to be some horrible burden. You go, you know, come on, let's do the arithmetic. You know, let's say someone's got $100,000 of 401k and they trade $10,000 of it, 10% of it each year. So we're talking about, take the Harkin bill. Again, I'd like a somewhat higher tax, but take the Harkin bill, 0.03%. So, you know, you just back that out. You're trading $10,000 a year. So 0.03%, that's $3. So that's going to kill you. You have a $100,000 account. Furthermore, people are already paying fees. You know, you already have, you know, I go, what's your 401k fee? Most people can't tell you. I don't blame them. Why would they know? But the point is they're already paying far more in fees than what you'd be talking about with this tax. So they don't even know the fees they're paying, but somehow a tax that might be a tenth as large or 20 as large, you know, that's going to break them. The other point, of course, is, and there's a lot of research on this, what you'd expect to happen in response to raising the cost of transactions is you'd have fewer transactions. And, you know, again, most people aren't directly managing their account, but what we would expect is that, you know, you have your money in a mutual fund or, you know, pension, mm-hmm. you know, pension fund managers, they would respond by trading less. So if the cost of transactions goes up by, let's say, 10%, then typically the evidence shows that they're going to reduce their trading by somewhere close to 10%. So that ends up being pretty much a wash. The only losers in this story are the people in the financial sector, which, again, you know, we need a financial sector, but we have an incredibly bloated financial sector. Finance is supposed to serve the productive economy. So if we could have just as productive an economy and have less resources wasted in shuffling assets back and forth, what's the problem?
Right. You would think that people who made their living from finance and have gotten quite wealthy from it would have a pretty good perspective on this. And from what I've seen, people like George Soros and Warren Buffett and John Bogle, maybe a little less famous, but he started the Vanguard mutual fund. They're all in favor of this, aren't they? Even though this is their bread and butter, this is what they do for a living. But they mm-hmm. think that there are benefits to this idea, isn't that right?
Well, that's right. And in particular, Bogle and Buffett, you know, who are long-term investors. I'll come back to Soros in a second because you know you can say mixed things about him. But in terms of Bogle and Buffett, they've been very clear. If you're a long-term investor, I mean, Buffett, you know, he's made his reputation. He goes and finds good companies and goes, "This is a good company." And he wants to hold it. He's not looking to buy it at 2 o'clock and sell it at 3 o'clock. So he couldn't care less that, you know, he pays a little bit of tax when he buys it and sells it because he wants to hold it for 20, 30, 40 years. And you look at that, that's what he's done with many companies. Now, in the case of Soros, he's very honest. He goes, "I'm there to make money." So if he could make money by buying at 1 o'clock and 2, selling it, he's going to do that. But he doesn't think that's good for society. You know, so he's totally honest on that. He's saying, "This is not good. You know, you leave me an opening like that, I'm going to take advantage of it as well other people. But that's not good. It shouldn't be there." So, you know, mm-hmm. you close that and he'll look for another way. And, you know, that's honest.
Right, right. And doesn't the support for this idea extend beyond this country and beyond financiers to political leaders like Angela Merkel and Sarkozy of France? You have a pretty impressive lineup of supporters for this idea, isn't there?
Absolutely, and I've been incredibly impressed by that because, you know, I've worked on this issue for, you know, pretty much since I came to Washington in 1992, and, you know, usually it's very much a backwater issue, but in the last year or two, you've had a lot more interest around the world, and especially in Europe, and you mentioned both Sarkozy, the president of France, and Angela Merkel, the chancellor in Germany. These are both conservatives. Mm-hmm. And, you know, originally they made some comments, and I, you know, you always take anything a politician says with a grain of salt. I mean, you know, maybe they mean it or maybe they just, you know, something came up in a focus group so they thought they'd say it. But no, they really do mean it. I've talked with people at the European Commission. In fact, a couple weeks ago I had occasion to meet with the European Commission's, in fact, their finance minister. They don't call him that, but in fact that's what he is, a minister of, I think it's revenue and customs or something to that effect. 100% behind the tax. He's thought about it very seriously, looked at all the issues for implementing a tax, and he's 100% behind it. So this is something that has very much mainstream support within the European Union, and I would say there's at least a 50% chance that they're going to have this in place by the end of next year. So I was really struck by that. This is not at all a fringe idea in Europe, and it's certainly not one anymore in the United States either, but it's, as I say, very close to being implemented in Europe.
Now, with the Obama administration, they've been pretty lukewarm on this idea, is that right? And I think that people in the European Union would like to see the United States take more of a supporting stance on it, right?
That's right. The Obama administration's been fairly open opposing the tax, and the European Union, the people of the European Commission were happy because they're saying they're not trying to stop the European Commission, at least as an official position. They're not trying to stop them from implementing the tax. There was concern they would actually try to obstruct it, but at least they're no longer doing that. So in that sense, you know, they have a more positive position of, you know, in effect neutrality towards the European Union adopting it themselves. But the administration has been fairly open in saying that they don't like the tax here. They've made arguments like it would be easy for people to flee to other countries. You wouldn't raise any money. It would disrupt capital markets. They seized on a study. There was a very preliminary study by the European Commission staff, which they're very clear about, by the way. They, you know, it's very, you know, there's all these question marks through it. Should we model it this way? You know, this is the way economists work. It's a new area. They're trying to figure out how to model the impact of the tax. And they found that it would lower GDP in the long run by around 1% point, which, you know, you'd rather not see. It's not a disaster, but certainly not good. And anyhow, the administration immediately seized on that, and they said, oh, look, you know, their own study showed it would lower. Well, it was a very incomplete study for reasons that I and others have pointed out, but the administration was eager to seize on that as an argument against the tax.
Do you see – what do you credit the increased visibility of this campaign to? I mean, you say you've been working on it for almost 20 years. Now it's very much on the front burner. Why do you think that's true?
Well, I don't think there's any doubt it's the economic crisis. You know, we saw that, you know, the United States, certainly Europe, much of the world, is still suffering from the impact of the collapses of the housing bubble in the United States and Spain and Ireland and the imbalances that were created as a result of that, and people have the sense that finance played a really big role in this, and there's certainly the view that we have to rein in finance. I mean, we spent, you know, in the United States, we loaned out trillions of dollars to banks to keep them from collapsing and wrecking the economy. Same story in Europe, same story elsewhere in the world, and, you know, no one wants to see that happen again. So given that, you know, we're going through hard times, we're talking about austerity, you know, Europe, United States, really just about everywhere. If you say we have to deal with budget deficits, what better way to deal with it than taxing the people who got us here and trying to make sure that they don't do it again? So it just makes an awful lot of sense.
Do you credit the Occupy Wall Street movement with bringing this issue as part of income inequality and tax equity more to the forefront?
Certainly in the United States. I mean, it was already moving in Europe, so I don't think, you know, you could attribute the movement in Europe particularly to that. But certainly in the United States, the fact that it's gotten much more attention, I mean, New York Times just had a big article about it, I think two or three days ago. It's been talked about elsewhere in the media. And, you know, Senator Harkin and Representative DeFazio were already interested moving on this before Occupy Wall Street, but it kind of lights a fire. I mean, there's no doubt about it. They see that, you know, there's a lot of interest in this, and that no doubt got them to move perhaps more quickly than they would have otherwise. It's probably helped them get co-sponsors. I don't know the exact number of co-sponsors at this point, but it's definitely increased interest among other members of Congress. I know the Progressive Caucus is very interested in it in the House, and, you know, I think many of them are likely to sign on to the DeFazio bill in the House, or some perhaps some senators, the Harkin bill in the Senate. So, you know, there's no doubt the Occupy Wall Street movement has helped build momentum for it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I have another question about going beyond raising revenue. I mean, is it possible to allocate that money raised to specific programs like, you know, development of infrastructure, that kind of thing? Because in the British Robin Hood tax campaign, it seemed to imply that we can take the revenue and use it towards things that would really actually, you know, help the middle class and the 99%. Is that something that's on the table here?
Well, there have been proposals to do that. Now, the Harkin-DeFazio bill doesn't have any specific designation to where the money would go. But certainly other people have made suggestions towards that. There may well be other bills that get introduced that do have a specific targeting of the money for a purpose like infrastructure. DeFazio, I believe it was 2 years ago, had introduced a bill in the House where I believe half the revenue raised was designated to go for infrastructure and other forms of public investment, which I believe included education, research and development. In other words, spending that would, in principle, make the economy more efficient, more productive, so that we're wealthier in the future. So there's no reason in principle that it couldn't be designated for that. I mean, there's always an issue that at the end of the day, money's fungible. So you could say, okay, we're using the financial transactions tax for this purpose, but then you cut back other spending on it. So, you know, the question is, can you find ways to avoid that if that's your intention to actually increase funding on it? But certainly there's no reason at all it can't be targeted. I know many people in the movement in the UK and elsewhere across Europe would like to see it targeted for various things.
Mm-hmm. I wanted to bring this back for a minute to the idea of tax equity, which is what we're we want to be working on the Commonwealth project. Because I'm just thinking, if you're a middle-class person and you want to transfer title to your car, say to a friend, there's not even any money changing hands. There are all sorts of fees associated with that. But if you are a hedge fund and you want to trade 100 million shares or, you know, some large $100 million worth of a stock, there's certainly fees involved, there's brokerage fees and stuff, but there's no transfer tax is basically what we're talking about here. And it just strikes me as another one of those examples where the tax system has gotten upside down, where the wealthier you are, the less you're troubled by taxes. And the most obvious example is the taxes on dividends and capital gains being capped at 15%, whereas if you actually earn the money through working, you can be charged up to 35%. Do you agree with me that it sort of fits into that paradigm of a reverse approach to taxation, where the wealthier you are, the more lightly you're treated?
Absolutely. And, you know, the International Monetary Fund even did a paper on this last year. They titled something like A Fair and Substantial Contribution from the Financial Sector. And the main point of that is that they see the financial sector as being hugely undertaxed, in the sense that, you know, just as you're saying, that transfers of property, but also, you know, your car, whatever, you'll pay all these fees. But on top of that, if we just think of it as, you know, it's an industry just like any other industry. Well, you go to the store and you buy a shirt. Well, you're going to pay sales tax on that, you know, at least in most states. You know, most of the things we buy, we're paying sales tax on, you know, 3%, 4%, sometimes 8%, depending where it is. And you go, okay, so now we're doing financial transactions, zero tax. Another way to think about it, you know, when we talk about the short-term trading, you know, with people buying at 1 o'clock, selling at 1:30, I think that is being very analogous to gambling. I mean, this isn't investment. I mean, you aren't making capital available to a startup software company or something. You're playing games. You know, maybe you're smart and you got the, you know, I do it well. That's great. They're wonderful and everything. But this is basically a form of gambling. So, you know, people are good at blackjack. They go to Las Vegas and they pay taxes on their gambling, not their winning. They pay taxes. The casinos pay taxes on gross, you know, gross revenue. And, you know, so if you gamble in Las Vegas, you pay a gambling tax. You know, people play the lottery. They pay a gambling tax. But if you gamble on Wall Street, you don't pay any tax. So you have this sort of special privilege. If you're a wealthy person who does their gambling in financial assets, no taxes. If you're, you know, a more middle-income person, you want to gamble at a casino or play the lottery or whatever it might be, you're going to be very heavily taxed.
Right. What you said there is an important point. Aren't there really two Wall Streets? I mean, the Occupy Wall Street movement has been very hard on Wall Street, and I think appropriately so. But isn't there the Wall Street, isn't there the financial system that allocates capital, that spreads risk, that does a lot of productive things that actually leads to starting businesses, expanding businesses, hiring people, coming up with new inventions? There's that Wall Street. And then there's the Wall Street that's just a casino, and in which there may even be a productive use to that as well. But it certainly seems to me, like you say, appropriate to extract some money from people who are not helping to build factories or windmills or anything else. They're kind of coasting along the surface of it and exploiting opportunities to make a lot of money very quickly. But I think do you agree with me that there are kind of two Wall Streets, and it's important to view them differently?
Yeah, well, I mean, the point here is that we want and need a financial sector. So it's not like we want, no one in their right mind would really want to tear down the financial sector. It serves a very important purpose. You know, this, as you say, people start businesses, they need capital, and the financial sector provides it. And we want that. We need that. But then on top of that, we have way, way more financial transactions that have nothing to do with providing capital to businesses. And, you know, one of the things in arguing this, the idea of this tax over the years, I remember not too long ago I was on a panel with someone from one of the Wall Street funds, and he said, well, if we had this, you'd raise our transactions costs back to where they were in the early 90s. You know, my response was, yeah, and was that a problem? I mean, you know, there's plenty of capital in the early 90s. We had a very large capital market, you know, very big, you know. So in terms of the productive uses of the financial industry, this barely touches it. I'm not going to say it doesn't touch it at all, but it just very,
right.
you know, it's a very modest impact. Where it does have a big impact is where you have the more casino-type structure where people are shuffling around money, you know, very rapidly for no
yeah.
immediate productive use.
Right, right. And the stock markets themselves have identified risks associated with that kind of activity. They now will halt trading or they'll restrict how quickly you can trade certain stocks in response to various crashes and upsets that have happened on them. So there's an identification even within Wall Street that this rapid transfer of money and assets can be a disruptive force, and they've tried to curb it. And this would just be one more part of that, I think.
Exactly. So you've had both, you know, recently the flash crash back in, I think it was May, where stocks fell somewhere around 8 or 9% in the span of a couple hours for you know, as best everyone could tell, it was just a programming fluke. And, you know, you had all these computer program trading that just fed on, you know, one fed on the other, and it just sent stock prices plummeting. Well, there's literally no news. It wasn't that, you know, something bad had happened and people over it. There was literally no news. And it was
right.
the same sort of thing that had the crash back in 87, that you had program trading, and there was nothing particular. You know, people looked really hard. There's nothing particular that was bad that happened that day that prompted this huge sell-off. It was just basically you had all this program trading that, you know, triggered this. And the response in both cases have been to set in breaks that, you know, would stop trading to you know,
right.
give people a breather and, you know, take a look at things. So the idea that markets might be better off with less trading, that
mm-hmm.
makes good sense. And, you know, again,
yep.
worth distinguishing, we have some stocks that trade very rarely of, you know, the some of the smaller stocks trade very rarely and go, okay, well, liquidity would be an issue with that. In other words, you know, I have my 1,000 shares of a computer startup and, you know, I really like
mm-hmm.
to sell half of them. Well, you know, that would be an issue, except this tax will have very, very little impact on that because you're talking
right.
about a very, very small tax. The other hand, where you have the larger stocks, you know, you have shares of General Electric or AT&T, this tax, you know, those stocks are already so hugely liquid. What you're talking about is if you have this tax, maybe instead of taking you 3 seconds to unload your 500 shares, it's going to take you 5 seconds, you know.
Yeah.
So what?
What do you think, this may sound like a naive question, but I'll explain why I'm asking it. What do you think the source of the opposition to this is? I mean, it seems like the obvious answer is people on Wall Street never wanted to give up a penny. They don't have to give up. But it seems to me a lot of these taxing issues, it doesn't seem as though it's entirely just a practical response based on I want to hold on to all my money. There's a deep kind of ideological aspect to it. So that people
mm-hmm.
who maybe not aren't even involved in high-speed, high-volume trading, they will go to the mats over something like this much more than a Wall Street professional who will just kind of accept it as another cost of doing business and move on. So where do you think the major opposition is coming from? Is it from the trading halls of Wall Street? Is it from these ideological think tanks who are just opposed on a philosophical level to any sort of tax or regulation?
Well, I think it's certainly both. I mean, you know, when you see the opposition, say, from the Obama administration, I think that is motivated by the concern that, you know, the Wall Street, the large banks have that they would lose money on this deal. But no doubt about it, there's this cultivation that a fear of taxation that somehow this is going to be devastating, that, you know, it's going to wreck the economy. I've already seen, you know, a number of pieces about this, and it's just kind of striking because, you know, I certainly hope this gets approved somewhere in the U.S., but sometime soon in the U.S., but that's not a 2011 mm-hmm. proposition, surely not even a 2012. You know, maybe this would be debated seriously by the next Congress. But this is really quite some time off, but already you've had some pieces, you know, saying how this crazy idea, it can never work, this and that, coming from, you know, the right-wing think tanks. So, you know, there's no doubt about it. They hate taxes in general, and this one in particular, I think in part because it could be a very effective tax. I mean, it's a way to hit the financial industry and have really
mm-hmm.
very little impact on anyone who isn't involved in large amounts of active trading.
I want to see if we could start to shift the focus a little bit to trying to figure out how to strategize to actually win on this. I mean, everyone is so desperate for a win because I think now there is an opportunity with the public attention so focused on the real issues like income inequality, what's wrong with Wall Street and money and politics. But I think, I guess my hope is that we can actually win on this. What do you think, Dean? I mean, do you know? I'm sure you talked to people on the Hill about this. Is it possible to win this right now?
Well, I don't think it's going to happen now, but I think the main point is to sort of start to build support. And you do have groups out there. I mean, the Nurses Union has been fantastic in going out pushing for this. So they've been a very vocal voice saying, look, there's a large amount of money to be had by taxing, you know, in essence, waste in the financial sector. So I think the first step is to get that known. And that's one reason why I thought it was so important that the Joint Tax Committee did a score of this bill by Harkin DeFazio. And just to explain this, people probably wouldn't understand, because unless you're sitting here in the Beltway, people have no idea what this means. But Congress never approve anything. Someone may find some obscure bill, but they never approve anything that hasn't been scored, basically an official number given to it, either by the Congressional Budget Office if it's a spending item, or by the Joint Tax Committee if it's a tax item, as this is. And what their bill did was it finally put a number on it, and, you know, in fact, a fairly good one. As I said, it was over $400 billion over 10 years. You could have a bigger tax, which I'd actually like to see. But in any case, $400 billion over 10 years is a fair bit of money. And what that is very helpful for from the standpoint of debate is you go, look, we have people in Congress who are talking about cutting Social Security. They're talking about cutting Medicare, Medicaid, funding for student loans, you know, on down this list. And here's an alternative. We don't have to do those things. We could instead get $400 billion simply by taxing waste in the financial sector. How does that sound? So I think it's a question of getting this to be something that people are comfortable with. And I think it can make a lot of headway, because, again, it's not something that I think most of the American people would have trouble with. You know, no one likes taxes. I mean, it's kind of a safe bet. You know, people aren't going to like taxing anything. But if you go, okay, we need money, and, you know, these are the things that are being thrown on the table. So what do you think? Do you want to see your Social Security cut, or do you think it's better to tax Wall Street? Do you want to see your Medicare cut? You know, so I think that it's important to develop the level of familiarity with the tax, which, you know, to this day, I'm sure even now, probably half the population has no idea what a financial transaction, or actually should be calling it speculation tax, the better name for it, financial speculation tax is.
There's a messaging very important. I'm sorry, go ahead, Annabelle.
No, I was just curious about, like, what you think of this popular term, the Robin Hood tax.
You know, I actually don't have that good a sense of that, because what I worry about is that sometimes has the connotation of sort of being vengeful against the wealthy, and, you know, I worry, you know, again, I have no problem at all saying that, look, these people who are engaged in this trading are not doing a public service, and there's no reason on earth we shouldn't tax them. But I worry that it may rub people the wrong way if it's seen as being kind of vengeful. Because I don't say it's vengeful, it's just that it's not productive activity, so why not tax it?
Mm-hmm. Right. I think in the Commonwealth Project, one of the things we're going to try to emphasize is that people who won the life lottery, like me, aren't acting from a position of guilt, but just responsibility and rationality. And I think that's an important part of this tax. And you were mentioning the nurses. Yeah, I've been on a couple of picket lines with National Nurses United, and their signs say "Tax Wall Street to heal Main Street." That's their slogan. And there have been hundreds of those signs. I was down in front of Eric Cantor's field office in Virginia a couple months ago, and there are a lot of "Tax Wall Street to heal Main Street" signs out there. So they definitely have adopted that as one of their principal agenda items.
Yeah.
I mean, the argument that I really like is actually that it would help stabilize the economy to reduce some of the speculation. So it would actually make the economy better overall. Is that
Yeah.
I think to me, that's a great argument.
Yeah, no, and I think that does it in several different ways. One is just that you can certainly have sort of destabilizing speculation. You have the extreme cases like the flash crash that we were talking about a moment ago, but, you know, it's not uncommon if speculative bubbles. Earlier this year, there was kind of one in oil. You know, it followed some fundamentals that we had Libyan oil off the world market, but clearly prices went beyond. They rose more than was justified by that. Now, I can't say this necessarily would have stopped it, but, you know, it may. It may in some cases do that. So on the one hand, it could reduce the sort of speculative run-ups or sometimes run-downs in prices that, you know, are just driven by sort of short-term trading going wild. Secondly, though, it could discourage people from sort of pursuing the path where they're spending their lives flipping assets. And what I mean by this is that we have a lot of people, you know, certainly there's a lot of very well-educated, very smart people who are working on Wall Street doing this, you know, buy at 1 o'clock, sell at 1:30, because you can make a lot of money that way. Now, you know, imagine Steve Jobs had done that. He may have not done it because, you know, he had his dreams about computers and everything, but suppose he had spent his life on Wall Street because he could have made a lot of money there. Maybe he'd been very good at that. Who knows, you know, but that would have been lost to society if we had had, you know, someone like him who, you know, could have been very productive in other areas instead being, you know, very smart at getting there, you know, 30 seconds before anyone else. It's very profitable for him personally, but provides no value at all to society. So if we could discourage people from, you know, devoting themselves to this sort of speculation, we all stand to gain by that. That instead of doing this, their abilities, their resources will be used on developing better computers, better software, you know, better things that actually benefit society rather than just in effect benefiting themselves.
I think another important part of it is to explain, as we've been talking about today, how this does not affect any kind of standard investor. I mean, I think one way that opponents of tax equity make their case is by drawing these false analogies or making the case that the middle class, a taxpayer or a middle class investor, is somehow in the same boat with the hedge fund investor or the hedge fund taxpayer. It's a difference of scale that's almost hard to understand. It's almost like a cosmological thing or something, but it's important, and it's not only here, but like on the inheritance tax. I think many, many too many Americans think that everyone somehow has to pay an inheritance tax. They don't understand it's only for people with assets, with estates above a certain amount. And I think here too, if someone thinks, well, you know, I have a Vanguard account, you know, with $50,000 in it, I certainly don't want that eaten away by transaction taxes. It's extraordinarily important to explain that that's not going to happen and who this is targeted at. And I think one reason it's so hard for people to understand this sometimes is that our economy has become so bifurcated between a tiny, tiny elite that controls huge amounts of income and assets and everybody else that many of these proposals only apply to that super elite, but the opposition often purposely tries to obscure that fact.
No, that's exactly right. And, you know, we see that again, just as examples you gave. So, you know, wherever we have a tax, there's always going to be a cutoff. So, you know, we have the estate tax, and I forget even where the current level is, but somewhere around $2 million. So, you know, that's pretty high up in the scheme of things. The vast majority of us aren't going to see $2 million. But there's someone who's going to actually have exactly $2 million or $2,005,000. And what they're going to do is, well, $2 million's not all that rich, and that's right. I mean, you can't buy huge mansions everywhere and own an eye. You know, no, you're not super rich. You're better off than most people. But let's say you have $2 million and $5,000. Well, of course, the tax just applies to the $5,000. So
right.
This person that they're looking at, and they're going, well, they're not super rich. They're not Bill Gates. You know, how are you going to tax them? We're going to tax them on the $5,000. So
right.
This person who's got a $2 million and $5,000 estate, they may end up paying $1,000 in taxes. You go, okay,
right.
They're not super rich. They paid $1,000 in taxes. So what?
Right.
You know,
right.
And that's the sort of story that, you know, the person who's got $100,000 in a Vanguard account, certainly they're not super rich. No, they're saving for retirement. You know, that's great they have something for retirement. They might pay a few dollars a year in the tax. You know,
again, it's
odds are they aren't even going to notice it. And again, in many cases, they're simply going to trade less and it'll end up being pretty much a wash. But if
right.
they end up paying a few dollars in the tax, well, they aren't the target of it. But, you know, that's really not going to be something that's going to be noticeable in their standard of living.
That's right. So making those distinctions as to who the target is, I think, is very important.
Mm-hmm. So, Dean, I mean, okay, so in terms of supporting this particular proposal by Harkin and DeFazio, where should we start? What's the best way to go about supporting that?
Well, I think, you know, one thing would be to, you know, the usual thing, people could write to their members of Congress, email them, you know, visit their staff and say, you know, look, this is a good thing. How come you're not on board? You know, what are the issues? And, draw them out. I think it would be good, say if you're not supporting it, why not? Have you considered it? What are the downsides? What would make you more likely to support it? I mean, you see anything good at all in it? So getting this discussed, I think, is a really big thing. Of course, part of the story also is taking advantage of the outlets that we have in the media, if we could try to get this mentioned in local newspapers. So, again, if people could do this as sort of a public act, if you get a group of people, it doesn't take a huge number, but get 10 or 15 people, go down to your local, to the office of your member of Congress and, tell the local media that, we want to go there and discuss the Harkin DeFazio bill with them, see where they stand. That might get some attention. So I think a huge amount of this is, at this point, is just getting the idea out there that here's a way we could raise lots of money and we could do it in a way that really doesn't hurt middle-income people at all and also would make the financial sector more productive, more efficient.
Mm-hmm. But don't you think it's important to get people in the financial sector to really come out very publicly in support of this, right? Some of the major financial institutions as well. Is it possible, do you think, to get some of them on board public?
I've been impressed with some that we've been able to get. It would be interesting to see to what extent we could get others. But, the fact that we got someone like John Bogle, who's kind of a legend, he started Vanguard, which is far and away the largest 401k fund. There's another term for it. I'm slipping
mutual fund.
Mutual fund. Far and away the largest mutual fund in the country, and a very well-run one, too. I'm not doing an ad for him, but it's a very efficient company. He makes a big point that they keep their fees to a bare minimum, and they minimize their trading, so that's also, so he's going, this is not going to hurt me. So, he's been a great spokesperson for it, and there are a few others. Now, whether you'll get, a Merrill Lynch or someone to come out there and say it's a good idea, I don't know. There might be some companies that will, again, it's great that Warren Buffett had signed on to the idea, so again, someone who's known as a shrewd investor, and again, someone who holds, he's not looking to buy at 1 o'clock and sell at 1:30. He's looking to hold for 20 years. So for him, this isn't an issue. So I'm sure there will be a few others like that, whether you get one of the big institutions to say, hey, this is okay. That I wouldn't bet on.
Isn't another part of the messaging, and in terms of another way of perhaps getting more people to make their living this way on board, is to draw the camera back and say, make the case that even if you benefit in the short term, superficially, by this kind of rapid trading and not having to pay any tax on this rapid trading, everyone has an interest in a more stable economy. Everyone has an interest in a better society, and you just have to look at it on a much broader screen. And if you did that, that's part of what's behind groups like the Coffee Party Commonwealth Project is wealthy people have made out very well by the taxing and spending policies of the last 30 years, superficially. But not only on an ethical basis, but on a larger practical basis, what has that meant in terms of increased spending on police protection and helping out kids who aren't getting proper education? So is it part of this issue in terms of getting allies and unlikely supporters is to make sure they're looking at it with the right perspective?
Yeah, and you certainly have had, you have people today, and you've certainly historically had many people. I mean, look, Franklin Roosevelt, many of us look as kind of our model president, in the sense of having, done so much to reform the economy in a positive direction. Here's a guy who was born to a very wealthy family, certainly was very wealthy throughout his lifetime, but yet he made all these changes with the idea that, he wasn't revolutionary, quite the opposite. He wanted to have a society that he wanted to live in, he wanted his children to live in. So it's, you will have people and hopefully more, we do have some and, the patriotic millionaires, you mentioned some of these groups that, are thinking that way, saying, yes, we've made a lot of money, they expect to be wealthy and they will be, but the idea is that, the point isn't to be absolutely as wealthy as possible. You also care about the sort of society you live in, the sort of society that you're handing on to your children, and you don't want to be in a country where, you have to worry everywhere you go that, there's crime, that you have to have police. Brazil, You know, I heard incredible stories about Brazil. People take helicopters not just because there's a lot of traffic, which there is, but they take helicopters from point A to point B so they can't be kidnapped. You know,
right.
You know that you could be very rich, but you know the idea that you have to get in a helicopter because if you walk on the street, you're worried someone's going to kidnap you or kidnap your kids. I mean, who really wants to live in a country like that?
Right, right.
Mm-hmm. Another kind of strategy question is, is it possible to get some prominent Republicans, maybe not currently elected ones, but people like Alan Simpson, other respectable former Republican congressmen to come forward and support this? Seems like Alan Simpson would support it.
That's a really good question. You know, in the old days, you could identify Republicans who might well have been supporters. You know, Romney's father, for one, you know, was a moderate governor of Michigan for, I think, two terms. I forget exactly how long he served, but he certainly was there for a while. You did have these moderate Republicans that were reasonably open-minded. It's much harder to find people like that today. Now, again, there no doubt are some out there, but it's not easy to define them, and part of that's been there's been this enforcement of ideological uniformity. I was actually interested or disappointed, I guess might be the right word, when Simpson and Bowles came out with their plan. You know, Simpson was very happy to say, oh, we didn't leave any whales untouched, and we even got some minnows. And you go, well, wait a second, you missed Wall Street. You know, you look at everything they wanted to tax or every area they wanted to cut, they didn't mention Wall Street. And you know, what was the motivation there? I don't know. I mean, one of the things that I find hard to miss, Bowles, Erskine Bowles, is on the board of Morgan Stanley. So does that have anything to do with it? I don't know. But, you know, it's hard not to notice that. So, unfortunately, they didn't mention financial transactions taxes as one of the things on their list of ways to raise revenue. So,
but I've heard him speak very disparagingly about what he called the money guys. I think the people he thinks are just out there making bets and speculating and disrupting the economy, you know.
So, well, it would be great if he would, you know, say some words about, you know, obviously he doesn't have to endorse any specific bill, but, you know, if he were to say that this is a place we should be looking for revenue, I think it would have a lot of impact.
Yeah, I think
I'm
he'd try that.
I'm also thinking, yeah. Mm-hmm. You know, it's often been commented that there's certain overlap between the Tea Party and Occupy Wall Street, and that they're both angry at Wall Street. There's this thread from left to right, an anti-Wall Street feeling. So I'm wondering if there's some way of phrasing or pitching or angling this that you could even get Tea Party or populist conservative support for it. Have you thought about that or tried to reach out to any of those forces?
Yeah, you know, and it's been interesting. You know, there's such an opposition to taxes. So on the one hand, you know, you have a lot of anger still over the bailouts, anger over what Wall Street's done to the economy, but
right.
There's still a lot of opposition to taxes. So the idea that, you know, and I have to say I find the view kind of incoherent in the sense not just that they're opposed to taxes, but they're also often opposed to regulation. So on the one hand, they're very hostile to Wall Street, and they go, okay, so we have to rein these guys in. They're endangering the economy. And they go, well, we don't want the government to regulate them. And go, well, what do you want exactly? And it ends up being very strange. They don't want them to be bad actors, but, you know, if you leave a door open to them, it's sort of hard to expect that they aren't going to take it.
Right, right.
Yeah, that's been my experience talking to conservatives from Tea Party movement is we often agree with the basic sentiment or the problem, but their solutions are so different. And I guess I don't quite understand how what they're proposing really could be viable solutions. But it's as if, I mean, at times I'm very sympathetic to what they're saying because I feel like they don't trust anyone. They don't trust Wall Street. They don't trust Washington. And they only kind of trust this notion, this abstract notion of liberty and individuals. And I just don't see how we can fix our problems just by looking at individual liberty. And so I guess that's where things have always stalled. It's like, oh, great, we agree these are problems, but I can't get beyond that to actual solutions. So I mean, that's been kind of my personal journey trying to talk to people, not moderate Republicans, because I feel like we're often in agreement, but real conservative anti-tax people.
Mm-hmm. And isn't you mentioned that the U.S. had a transfer tax like this? I think I was reading some material before we talked. I think it was 1914 to 1966 or something. And the first quarter century after the Second World War is when the great American middle class was built. It's when there was widespread prosperity. And that was a time of relatively high taxation, relatively high regulation. And it's in the last 30 years where we've had much lower taxes on higher income people and corporations, much more lax regulation. Do you think that juxtaposition is being accurately made, and that if it was made better, that something like the speculation tax would be easier to sell?
It's not being accurately made. I mean, I think very, very few people have any clear understanding of it. And, you know, part of it is that, you know, the right has been so, you know, just absolutely crazy about raising taxes, you know, job killer, job killer, job killer. And the media feels the need that somehow, because you have the Republicans saying that they have to treat that as though it's a respectable position. And, I'm an economist. I know the research on this. Taxes do have some negative impact on the economy in the sense that if someone is paying, you know, go back to the pre-Reagan era, they're paying 70% marginal taxes. We can go back to the pre-Kennedy era, it was 90%. There's no doubt about it. There's some negative impact. They will work somewhat less. But it doesn't go to zero. So, you know, what a serious person would say is, okay, we can get more tax revenue from the wealthy, and there will be some negative impact. And you weigh those two. You go, okay, so, you know, how big is that impact? And that's the way the question should be framed. But instead we just get job killer, job killer, job. No, it doesn't. It's not, no one is going to just say, okay, I'm not going to, you know, I'm going to shut down my business because you raised my tax by 4%. The world doesn't work that way. There's nothing to support that. And what we have to do is just try and get this to a serious discussion and say, look, the economy operated very well. We had great growth over the years, you know, the 40s, the 50s, the 60s, into the 70s, with much higher tax rates than we had today, much more regulation than we had today. Doesn't mean that the tax rates caused it, doesn't mean that the regulations caused it, but obviously they didn't prevent it. So, so what we want to do is say, okay, so we could raise taxes by, you know, so much to have some negative effects, sure. But is it worth it because we're going to get revenue that will allow us to do X, Y, and Z? That's the way we have to have the discussion. But unfortunately, it's very, very hard to have that discussion. And that's the sort of thing, as I say, serious people can't dispute that. I could have a conservative. I could have Martin Feltzman, a very prominent conservative economist, you know, Reagan's top economic advisor. He might disagree with me on the policy, but he won't disagree with that framing. He's not going to say that the economy shuts down if we raise the tax rate to, you know, back to the pre-Reagan levels. How can he say that? It's absurd.
Right. I want to ask you something else, Dean, before we close out on the show. I've been wanting to ask you this about your position in general on the bailout, right? Can you just very kind of quickly summarize like what your position was on the bailout?
I think the bailouts as they were a disaster, because basically what we did was we left the whole financial structure, the whole financial industry in place. So here it is. You had these people that had largely wrecked the economy, wrecked their firms, and basically were allowed to pay no consequence from it. Very few, you know, most of these people walked away with huge amounts of money. Some of them probably had engaged in criminal activity, if not criminally stupid activity, because they brought their firms down. They walked away clean, you know, basically unscathed. Now, my first best choice would have been to say, here's the money. We have an interest in keeping you in business, because it would have been very bad news, you know, certainly in the fall of 08 to see, you know, Citigroup and Bank of America and many of the other big firms that were almost certainly insolvent. It would have been very bad news to see the chain reaction of one after another go down. So my first best choice would have been, here's the money. We're cleaning you out so that, you know, your top management go get new jobs. Your shareholders are out of luck. Not because we want to nationalize the bank, but that's what's supposed to happen when your company goes out of business. Your shareholders lose their money. That's the way capitalism is supposed to work. And the creditors will take somewhat of a hit. You know, they won't get, you know, 100 cents on the dollar. And we could take some time and determine how much exactly they'll get. There are ways we could do that, and we've done this in other contexts. And, you know, and so we'd keep them in business, but we would, you know, make sure that the people responsible for this disaster paid a price. I actually said that I would have opposed the TARP, you know, even to the last, because the Fed had the ability, which, you know, most of the bailout actually ran through the Fed rather than the Treasury. The TARP, they only appropriated $700 billion, and I think the most that ever went out was somewhere around $500, whereas the Fed had over $2 trillion out at its peak. So much more of the bailout was done through the Fed than through the TARP. So we had the ability to keep these businesses going without the TARP, without basically giving them the blank check that they ended up giving them. So I wanted to see the institutions. I didn't want to see, you know, a chain of bankruptcies. That would have been very, very bad news. But, you know, but we could have imposed terms. Now, the other thing I've said is even in that worst-case scenario, people are talking about a second Great Depression. The first Great Depression didn't just come about because we had bad action at the beginning. In other words, we did have everyone collapse at the beginning. That wasn't what gave us 10 years of double-digit unemployment. What gave us 10 years of double-digit unemployment was that we never responded to it adequately. We eventually got out of the Great Depression and got back to full employment with the spending associated with World War II. But we could have done that same spending in 1931 rather than 1941. So the idea that even in a worst-case scenario, we would have faced a second Great Depression, that was absurd because we know how to get out of that. So even the worst-case scenario that they were hanging over our heads, that was a serious misrepresentation of what we faced, because even in the case of a complete meltdown, which no doubt about would have been very bad news, we wouldn't have had a decade of double-digit unemployment unless for some reason we just didn't respond adequately, which, you know, again, you can't blame the original set of events. That would be a prolonged policy failure.
Right.
Mm-hmm. So what's your overall prescription for fixing the economy right now?
Well, I'd agree with, you know, I'm a big fan of Krugman. I read his stuff regularly, and I say some of it goes both ways. He occasionally reads my stuff. I think, you know, he's exactly right. We need more stimulus in the short term. We need to get the economy back on a sound footing, and that's really got to be front and center, because you have people that, you know, they've been unemployed long periods of time. They're losing their homes. Families are breaking up. You don't recover from that, or they don't recover from that, I should say. I mean, the economy will face a loss, but those people who are unemployed face a huge, huge loss. And that really has to be priority number one. And I just, it's very discouraging to me how, you know, sort of this acceptance that we're just going to live with this prolonged period of unemployment, like, oh, we have to tough it out. And what I find so painful about that is almost invariably the people who say we are going to have to tough it out are not toughing it out. These are mostly people who have six-figure incomes, and you know, maybe they have some sympathy for the people who are actually out of work, but they're not toughing it out. They're doing just fine. And I, you know, given that the people are unemployed, it's not their fault. They aren't the ones that wrecked the economy. It was the people in policy positions who were, you know, too incompetent, maybe corrupt. But this is a totally preventable disaster, and the people who were charged with preventing it didn't do their jobs. They haven't suffered at all, whereas we have millions, tens of millions of people across the country who are unemployed, underemployed, given up looking for work altogether. They're the ones doing the suffering. That's not acceptable.
Yeah. And the speculation tax is really a very moderate response to all this. I just wanted to say that along with what a lot of the patriotic millionaires and the Coffee Party Commonwealth Project are trying to do, are very moderate responses. There's not a leveling campaign. It's not eat the rich. It's a very rational, responsible approach to this vast disparity of wealth and income that we have in this country right now, and a desire to bring some degree of balance back.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And when you talk about going back to where we were in the, you know, the 50s, 60s, and 70s, I mean, no one thought of that as a radical proposition. You know, again, you could argue over the best tax rate or whatever, but no one thought that Richard Nixon was a radical leftist, you know, and he was okay with the 70% marginal tax rate.
So before you go, Dean, I want to ask you more personally. It's very easy to get overwhelmed, you know, reading the news and just feeling like there's so many things wrong, so many things that need to be fixed, and there's terrible gridlock in Washington. I'm just wondering, like, you know, you've been inside Washington for years, and you understand what's wrong with the economy, and you talk to organizers. Like, what gives you hope going forward? Like, you know, share with us what gives you hope. And
well, you do see progress. You see victories. You know, some time ago, I mean, this is an obscure thing, but back in the mid-90s, there was this effort to cut the cost of living adjustment for Social Security through the consumer price index, changing consumer price index. And everyone said it was a done deal. And we stopped it. You know, it was kind of a fluke. It was, I won't go into all the details on it, but we managed to stop that. So you every now and then you could see you could have an impact. The other thing I'll just say that, you know, it's just such a different world than what we had 10 or 15 years ago with the Internet. Because if you go back to the mid-90s, you know, if you couldn't get on the news, you know, a National Public Radio or, you know, New York Times or Washington Post, you didn't exist. And now, you know, you have such an ability to reach people through the Internet that I think the potential for change, as bad as you have with things like Citizens United and corporations giving all sorts of money to, you know, right-wing candidates and everything, those are huge problems. But we have an ability to fight back that wasn't there 10 or 15 years ago. So as bad as things could be in many ways, you see the victories where they occur, and then you see the possibilities. So, you know, I just say the most important thing is don't get unrealistic hopes. I mean, I'm old enough that, you know, people a little older than me were in the 60s, and they all talk about being disillusioned. Well, they thought the whole world was going to change because they had a big protest. That was unrealistic. So you were going to be disillusioned. And, you know, try and have realistic targets, and, you know, the best you could hope for is piecemeal progress.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you. Thanks so much for taking the time to talk to us, Dean. This is great. And our organizers often use this as kind of tutorial for issues. So thank you. I really appreciate it. And we would love to have you back again.
Happy to do it. Thanks a lot for having me on. I enjoyed the discussion.
Thanks. Thank you, Dean.
Sure. Have a good weekend.
Thanks.
Bye.
Bye. Hey, Will.
Yay.
Hey. Wow. I feel like I learned so much in that hour. It's going to take me a while to process it. Eric, are you still there?
Yeah, that was awesome.
Yeah, that was a great conversation, Will. So, yeah, what do you guys think about this? I want to just kind of digest a little bit before we get off the phone. Eric, starting with you, what's on your mind now?
Well, what I really like about the way Coffee Party is approaching these kind of complex issues is that it doesn't require you to be an expert when you begin. You can go through a process of learning in a community of people who also are willing to admit that they may not have the answers going in, but want to go through that process because they care enough about our country's future that they want to be able to really have their vote count and their advocacy count by learning what our country really needs. So, you know, I'm not one of those people who knows the answers going in. You and Will know a bit more than me, and Dean Baker sounds like he knows, you know, a great deal. But if we all work together on this and we go through this learning process together, I think we could be a really powerful movement that's not only good for the country, but I think it's good for the people who engage in it. It's like it's like going to graduate school, you know, but with friends.
I mean, I totally agree. What's on your mind, Will?
Well, I think I said a few times, and because I believe it, that this issue fits in very easily into the larger issue of tax equity.
Mm-hmm.
The idea of those with the most, you know, contributing the most, but also the moderation of it, that Coffee Party Commonwealth Project is not calling for, you know, confiscation of large estates or anything. It's just saying, let's be reasonable and rational about this like we haven't been for the last 30 years. In the case of the speculation tax, they're saying, let's go back to something we had for 50 years, a period of great growth and prosperity in this country. Let's look to where the money is, find out how that can be best used for public purposes, and people can still get rich, they can still lead their own lives, but we just have greater balance in society than we have now. I think this is the speculation tax, what we're trying to do with the Commonwealth Project is a return of balance. It's not an extreme at either end. And I think a lot of what the country's suffering right now is a lack of balance, and that's what Occupy Wall Street and other protests have been about.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I guess, I mean, what I'm kind of thinking about is, And even before this conversation, I was kind of thinking along these lines that, I mean, I said this towards the end with Dean, it's like, I just feel there's so many things that just feel so wrong. And it's just, it is overwhelming. And I think that, the fact that Occupy Wall Street hasn't drilled into just one
hasn't come out with that one demand, and it took the coffee party months to come out with our position paper, is partly because, you know, we're in this period where, like our institutions are really breaking down, period. And so, you could focus on any number of things and feel like, okay, this has to get fixed immediately, right? And I guess back to kind of what, you know, Eric was saying is, I mean, you know, part of, I think, what we have to do is just simply be willing to learn this stuff and to be part of the dialogue and to be part of the, you know, solution, but problem solving. And that I think we have to commit to being students and learning and to help, you know, other people learn. And I think that is something that Coffee Party can really bring to the table. And it fits so well with Occupy, because I think with Occupy, it's a really a call to action to take ownership of your government, of our government and our institutions. And so I think between the two, I think those are two very important elements of what we have to do as citizens going forward, is to both have that commitment to learn and to have that sense of responsibility and ownership. Like, no one else is going to swoop in and fix this. Like, it's a lot of work and heavy lifting for us. It's definitely going beyond voting, but, you know, we have to be the ones taking the lead.
Yes.
Yeah, I think that's one of the most, I think, the most beautiful things about the spirit of Occupy. Before they needed to start fending off attacks from 1% media and, unfortunately, from law enforcement, that it was a place to learn. And they were so welcoming and so pleased when people from the conservative side of the political aisle would come to learn and to share with them. And I think that that's, in some ways, that's the definition of being transpartisan, as you don't go into it with the party platform of answers. So Dean was talking about how many people who are consumers of 1% media think that taxes and regulation are always bad. And so whether we have an economic crisis or we have a booming economy, we should always have less taxes and less regulation. It's always the solution. Well, they get that because they really have no exposure to any other kinds of ideas, and they haven't yet developed the openness to exchange ideas with the assumption that you might not necessarily know all the answers just because you're an avid consumer of a particular TV show. So I think that if we can convince more people to enter into the conversation with that recognition that whether it's the Democratic platform, the 1% platform, the Republican platform, or an amalgamation of them, that you come into it with, if you're willing to learn without having assume that, you know, the best way to respond to each new idea is to refer back to what your favorite program told you this morning or has been telling you for the last few years, I think we can come up with some new answers. Because I think it was Einstein who said no problem was ever solved by looking at it within the constructs in which it was created.
Right.
You know, I mean, you know, I think part of the challenge that this is a really tough one for the Coffee Party. Is this, you know, when we are calling, it could be a completely semantic problem, but when we call for dialogue, often people respond by saying, but we don't need dialogue, we need to fight. And they see this contrast between having that dialogue and learning and fighting, because they feel like we're being victimized and things are being taken away from us. And I think that, you know, what I've been trying to say all this time is, like, it's not necessarily an either or. Like, you know, democracy is that process where we can do both. It's about deliberation and decision making. And when you say deliberation, that includes learning, debating, talking, as well as saying, this is what we're going to actually do, right? And really, you know, arguing a point. And so I guess I think that's the word and the process that's missing, is deliberation.
And if I can just add, I think rather than just parroting what you hear on your TV show, if everyone brings their personal experience to the table, in addition to learning, sharing their personal experience, and I know I'm shamelessly promoting this thing, but I'll just say it again, that's part of what we want to do with the Commonwealth Project, is have everyone bring their experience to the table, in this case, about taxation and public spending.
Right.
That's the unique information you have, is your personal story. And that's what you almost have an obligation to share. In our case, whether you're someone who's economically well off or someone who's not well, economically well off, you still have a particular unique perspective that is very real and adds immeasurably to the dialogue.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Yeah. I did this radio interview last night with a university radio station, Hofstra University in New York, and they were basically giving me the same kind of disdainful, you know, position that, oh, we're sick of the kumbaya that's coming from, you know, the coffee party and Obama administration, you know, that doesn't work, right?
Mm-hmm.
And, my response to that is, you know, when we're saying we have to transcend our partisanship and that we have to talk to one another and we have to have deliberation, we're basically asking people to respect each other as individuals and see each other as individuals, saying, I want to hear from you as Will Rice, as an individual, not Will Rice, the progressive, or, you know, however you identify yourself, Will. You know, but I want to hear from Will Rice, and I think just putting a label on you makes me not interested, because then I'm going to just assume I already know what you're going to say.
Right. And I think that like on the issue of taxes, I have a particular experience with taxes. I know from my personal experience that the tax system is skewed. But I always want to hear other people's experiences, both in terms of taxing and spending, and all the other issues that are important. So I think that's very important. I think you serve yourself and you serve the community well if you bring your personal story to the table and you're willing to be open and honest and forthright about it.
Yeah. So, I mean, Will, when did you start getting really passionate about this issue of tax equity?
Well, I've been concerned about it for a long time, but like a lot of people, I'd never done anything about it. Because, as I've said in a couple of things I've written, personal finances are the last taboo. People will talk about their sex life more easily than they will about their personal finances.
That's so true.
And I guess it was hearing on the radio, again, I can trace this back to Occupy Wall Street, because I heard on the radio Eric Cantor, the majority leader in the House of Representatives, saying that the Occupy movement was pitting one group of Americans against another group of Americans. And I thought, wait a minute, I'm on the other side. I don't know if I'm officially in the 1%, but I'm somewhere in the low figure percentage tile. And I thought, I'm with the 99. That's where my spirit and my passion and my beliefs lie. So I talked to some other people involved in this movement, and he said, well, there's this Tumblr, there's a famous Tumblr website where people who are posting messages about being part of the 99%. But he said there's also now one called we're in the 1% and we stand with the 99. So I did one of those Tumblr pictures, and then I wrote an op-ed about it that got syndicated to about a dozen newspapers and now is up on the Coffee Party website.
And let me give you the URL. It's coffeepartyusa.com/money-closet to read Will's first article called Coming Out of the Money.
Because I describe it as coming out of the money closet, because it has money is a very emotional issue and it has sociological implications. It's not just a green eye shade dollars and cents thing. So people are hesitant to talk about it, whether they're extremely affluent or extremely needy. There are reasons, there are sociological reasons why people don't just go around talking about it. But I think that secrecy, that tendency to keep it undercover, can lead to mischief, to use a light word, because then all these debates about taxing and spending are entirely abstract, and nobody knows where anybody stands personally or stands to be affected personally. And I think by making it more personal, it makes it more real and informs the debate in a way that makes it more useful and more possible to reach good good decisions?
Well, we're breaking down that false paradigm of left versus right, rich versus poor, even 99% versus 1%. It's true.
Is that you, Will? I'm going to mute you for a second. Okay,
it's closer. I think 99% versus 1% is closer to the truth than Republican versus Democrat or left versus
mm-hmm.
right. Certainly
mm-hmm.
closer to the truth than all the white versus Hispanic, gay versus straight, the war on Christmas, and all of the kind of ridiculous constructs that 1% media put forward to divide us and to distract us from the real issues. But what Will is saying is that even the 99% versus 1%, which Eric Cantor was trying to in some ways push forward by saying, here you are trying to attack the rich. And what Will is saying is he's just raising his hand and saying, hold on, I'm an example of how that construct doesn't work. I might be in the 1% in terms of, financial assets, but I care about the country as a whole first and foremost. So let's talk about that in terms, instead of what 1% of the country wants versus 99%, because I think the majority of people who actually fall in the 1% may love money a great deal, but they love the country more.
Yeah. I wanted to ask you, Eric, because you're a great wordsmith and have such a sensitivity to visual and written language. I'm just wondering about this problem that we're always faced with as organizers. How to get people to get out of that kind of ideological framework that really stymies their thinking and progress, just the whole grip, mental grip that the extreme right wing has on the word tax, on the idea of tax. It's like that just drives me crazy. I feel like, maybe we need to say call taxes something else. Because I feel like it really stands in the way. It's a real big barrier to progress because they can't think about these solutions, that have anything to do with the word tax. The whole Robin Hood tax business, it's like a lot of people, even a lot of the progressive organizers who support this tax would say, oh, that's a terrible word for it, a terrible phrase for it. And I'm very ambivalent about it as well. But what do you think about the rhetorical challenge?
Well, I saw you guys sort of move through the call from Robin Hood tax to what was it, speculation tax?
Yeah, he calls it financial speculation tax, yeah.
Yeah, I think that's a better word.
Yeah.
But, the interesting, I've listened to someone like Dean Baker talk about this, who's been fighting on these issues for decades. And then there are people like you and Will I'm listening to who in recent years have decided to step forward and show courage and say, wait, the framework under which you are arguing is false. And let's
mm-hmm.
take a second look at this in a transpartisan way. I think that people like Dean, who are still in it after all these years, have just come to accept that
yeah.
it really doesn't matter what's true in American politics. What matters is what you can make people believe.
Yeah.
And the problem Dean has faced, and all of us have faced, especially over the last 30 years, let's just say it's from 1980 until 2006, that not only was money concentrated into the hands of a very few families and corporations, but also communications technology. We did away with all of the antitrust laws and the kind of, what was it called, where there had to be some balance. If you called it news, it had to have some objectivity, fair, what was it called?
The doctrine, the fairness doctrine, yeah.
Yeah, the fairness doctrine. So we did away with all of those things at the very time as we were concentrating wealth and communications technology into the hands of a few mega corporations and a few families. And so if you have come to accept, as I think Dean has, that it doesn't matter what's true in American politics, it's what you can make people believe, up until 2006, we were at a tremendous disadvantage, and that's why the policies all favored the 1% between 1980 and 2006, without any reprieve, because
mm-hmm.
what you can make people believe was under the control of the 1%. They controlled all of the mass media communications technology. Now, that has been changing, And I chose 2006 because that's the year that I met you, Annabelle. And it's also the year that you and I began to experiment with using new media technology, YouTube and Facebook and Twitter, to have a different message available to the people. Because when the people start to recognize that there were actually two messages, then they realize that there could be more than two, and their mind just expands exponentially just by looking at the world in a different way, lifting that box off your head for the first time. And that's why I have so much hope, because since 2006, we have seen an explosion in new media technology. We've seen an explosion in the number of people who are adept at using new media technology, and this live stream stuff that is actually fueling the Occupy movement. And, you know, it began with Madrid and Global Revolution, this organization that takes donations in order to make it possible to give this kind of technology to people with no resources at all, just a lot of heart, just a lot of patriotism, trying to do good for their country, to give those people a voice. It's not going to be nearly as powerful as the voice of the 1% media, but to give them just a piece of the conversation, as the Occupy movement has done in this country and other movements around the world have done in recent years, facing oftentimes much more brutal dictators and much more brutal 1% oppression, that's when you get a fighting chance. And I think we're just the beginning of that. And I think that this revolution is something that many in the 1% saw coming. I think they saw it coming with the way that Howard Dean was able to challenge the establishment candidate for president in 2004. I think they saw it the way Barack Obama was able to challenge the establishment candidate in 2008, and in many ways, Ron Paul.
Mm-hmm.
The same thing
right.
in 2008 and this year. And so these drastic measures, like the Citizens, mm-hmm. and Citizens United decision, the Supreme Court's decision that corporations can spend unlimited anonymous money to influence our elections. These are desperation measures, because this idea that media itself can be democratized so that the people can actually be part of the conversation, that is huge. That's the biggest thing to happen in this century, and I think it's going to have a huge impact on the way this century plays out.
Okay. I'm going to bring Will back in. Will, are you in a quiet place now?
Yeah, quieter anyway. I
don't know if you heard all that from Eric, but Eric had a lot to say.
No, he did. No, I did hear it, and I was very impressed by it. He was eloquent as always. I'm just hoping that the Coffee Party Commonwealth Project will carry on in the best traditions of the Coffee Party in, as you said, engaging in dialogue, not taking extreme ideological positions, not taking unthinking ideological positions, but rather starting from the most real place of all, which is everyone's personal experience. So it's unlike a lot of these other groups, like the Patriotic Millionaires, Responsible Wealth, and several others, Wealth for the Common Good. Membership is not restricted to people who have a lot of money. It's restricted to everyone who cares about the country, whether they have a lot of money or a small amount of money or somewhere in between. And the idea is to make those connections between each other and between spending and taxing decisions and how it affects each of us in a way that would make the debate more fruitful and one hopes move towards a more rational taxing and spending policy.
I have a fun question for you guys before we get off the phone. What is a Christmas wish for you guys? Or just a holiday wish, I think it's a Christmas wish. This is just fantasizing here. My fantasy as an organizer, as a citizen who would like to see change in America, is for us to actually acquire a major network. I'm wondering if we can raise enough money to buy something like CNN and rename it Coffee Party News Network or something, and you know, not have to work so hard to make ideas go viral. I mean, I believe in that as a model, but it is so hard. Imagine if we had a major network promoting everything that we did, like the Tea Party did at some point. My God, we would have so much impact, you know, and then we could actually rename another wish, holiday wishes. I want to rename taxes to something like, you know, Patriot's Fee or something. That would make it seem like a really positive thing as opposed to something close to death, you know. So anyway, so those are like my fun holiday wishes for.
Well, Will, before you share yours, let me just again say coffeepartyusa.com/money-closet is where you can read Will Rice's coming out essay. And at the bottom of that essay, below the comment section, is a sign-up form if you want to join that movement. And it's like Will said, it's not restricted to people who are coming at this from the perspective of having wealth and feeling a sense of responsibility to be part of the conversation because of it. Will really would like to have that conversation with everyone in America, but with an openness about financial interest that, as Will was saying, we haven't had enough of in this country. And Annabelle, I mean, that's a strange wish because it's so impossible.
it's fantasy wish.
Yeah, I mean, what I was saying, though, is that we are part of a larger conversation. Coffee Party, you know, we have 407,000 fans on Facebook, and we have a good email list, and a lot of people follow us on Twitter. We're just one voice in the 99%, since that's the best term we have right now. And, yeah, the other side has a tremendous amount of money, and they can package things. They can use all the beautiful chyrons and graphics. They can get actors to pretend like they're journalists. They can get actors to pretend like they're experts on politics. And they can do all kinds of packaging to create a show that, yes, a lot of people watch, but less and less every day. And during that time, more and more people are going to be watching our YouTube channel or the live stream channel from Global Revolution and from the Occupy movement. They're going to be looking at Dean Baker's organization. They'll be looking at Josh Silver's organization. And, yeah, it's going to be spread out, and everybody's going to be advocating in different ways. And sometimes people are going to say, gosh, I wish we could all just get on one news channel and have one voice consolidate everything. But, see, that's the problem with what happened to the Tea Party. When they made that deal with the devil, and 1% Media said, we'll give you lots of advertisement if you carry our water, suddenly this group that was against the bank bailouts and against the domination of Wall Street over our economy suddenly became the populist advocates for Wall Street and for their domination of our economy. And I think that was an extremely demoralizing thing for the real grassroots of the Tea Party. We don't need that to happen in the progressive movement. And honestly, it's impossible for that to happen because it would be antithetical to what we believe in. So I think it's going to be just this messy democratization of media that rises up in mass. They've got a lot of money. We've got a lot of people. And now we've got some communications technology as well. So, yeah.
I still want to buy CNN, Eric.
Okay, well, what's your tip?
Okay, by the way, we only have a few minutes. So I want to go to Will, but before that, I do want to remind people to support the growth of the Coffee Party by becoming a member, or if you're already a member, become a donor. You can actually get some really great Christmas gifts right now if you become a member or donate to us. So you can go to coffeepartyusa.com and look for that. We would really appreciate it. Okay, Will, what are your closing thoughts? You have a few minutes.
Well, I can outdo you in terms of the extravagance of my wish. My wish is to transform the national conversation on money, on spending, on taxes. I mean, there are obviously natural limits to honesty. Discretion is important. But I think we can get a lot more open with one another about what our monetary situation is. And I think that openness would in turn lead to better public policy outcomes. So that's what I'm hoping. I don't have a realistic expectation that I can or that our group can immediately have that kind of widespread impact. But I'm hoping that it could be the start of something that will spread and lead to a healthier, happier society, because there's an important part that's not being kept secret and thereby badly influencing how we make our laws.
Mm-hmm. Nice.
Will, no matter how big or how small your Coffee Party Commonwealth group grows, just know that when one person, even one person, stands up, it's contagious. It has a ripple effect. So each person who decides to do that, they're going to inspire 5 or 10 more people to do it. So you already, I can see your email list growing because I get a notification each time someone signs up. You're already inspiring people, giving them hope. And that, I think that the transpartisan learning process is something that we can especially that's the one thing that we can offer more so than those organizations that put themselves kind of firmly in a ideological stance.
Yeah. Okay, well, great. Thanks for joining, Will, and feel free to program your own shows. Like, if they're guests that you want to invite, just, you know, we have this great format, Blog Talk Radio, so feel free to create your own shows. And Eric, thanks for joining and for your great comments at the end. And we'll see everyone back next week. I'm going to actually do a bunch of shows, and, you know, Eric and Will, you guys are invited to join me for any of that. Next, I think we're going to have at least three next week. So I'm looking forward to you know, asking some of our coffee party members about the next year, to reflect on the next year, right? You know, what are our hopes and goals for next year? So thanks everyone, and we'll talk to you soon. Bye, Will.
Thanks,
bye,
a
Eric.
Thanks,
Annabelle. Thanks, Will.
All right, bye.
Bye.
Bye, Eric.
Okay. The future is a hefty responsibility, and not one that we take lightly, but then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on chumbacasino.com. I looked over at the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. Coincidence? I think not. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere, even at 30,000 feet. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's chumbacasino.com and live the Chumba life.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.